coming up on this week's mini episode of the Drew Perowit Podcast.
If you're 1 point away from being pre-diabetic, does that mean that you're totally in the clear? The answer is no. And the research suggests that as you move higher in the normal range towards a pre-diabetic fasting glucose level, your risk for a whole host of diseases, from stroke to heart disease to, of course, developing type 2 diabetes or obesity, all go up very significantly.
Considering we spend about 1/3 of our day sleeping, wouldn't it make sense that we spend just a little bit of time creating the right environment for a deep night's rest? Let's talk bed sheets in that vein, because they're a super important part of a good night's rest. I want to tell you what my dream wish list for everything that I'd want in the perfect set of bed sheets. Number one, comfort. Because if they're not comfortable, nothing else matters. Number two, temperature regulation. So much science is coming out about the importance of keeping your body in the ideal temperature range at night. Not too hot, not too cold. So it's super important to regulate temperature to get that great night's sleep. Number three, non-toxic. So here's the crazy thing. Sleep is supposed to support our natural detoxification process. Why the heck would we want to expose ourselves to additional toxins at night with the wrong set of bed sheets? So I'm pretty pumped to tell you about a brand that meets all these requirements and more. Cozy Earth is my go-to when it comes to the most comfortable, temperature-regulating, and non-toxic sheets on the market. Their bamboo sheets are the softest sheets I've ever freaking slept in. My wife agrees, by the way, and they are hypoallergenic, which means they're naturally antibacterial plus toxin free. But don't just take my word for it. Oprah Winfrey herself has named Cozy Earth on her top list of favorite things 3 years in a row. And I don't know about you, but I'm Team Oprah all the way. Right now, with you being part of my community, you can get 40% off Cozy Earth Sheet Set, which is the highest discount they've ever offered. Just head over to CozyEarth.com and use the code DrewPodcast. That's Cozy, C-O-Z-Y, Earth.com with the code DRUPodcast, P-O-D-C-A-S-T. If you missed that, it's in the show notes. And if you're on the fence, keep in mind that Cozy Earth's sheet come with a 10-year warranty. So check out CozyEarth.com with the code DrewPodcast. Prescription drugs can have some benefits when they're used in the right way, but it's also important to recognize that they can also deplete key nutrients. Physicians call this MIND, or medication-induced nutrient depletions. And of course, if we're using a prescribed drug to help us with one problem, we don't want to be causing another. Just like many of you, I have people in my life who are on long-term medications like antidepressants, birth control, or statins. Maybe you're currently taking one of these prescriptions yourself. My friends and family who are on long-term prescription meds have found, through working with a practitioner or functional medicine doctor, that in some cases they've become deficient in some critical nutrients. The key is to find out which nutrients can become depleted as a result of long-term medication and replenish these nutrients. A company recently approached me called Even, and they've actually developed an entire whole system and program to help you do just that, replenish what's been lost while using certain medications. Their products are created by physicians, nutritionists, pharmacists, and experts who've identified the exact recipe to rebalance nutrient levels and biochemistry while taking certain meds. Currently, they have formulas for you or anyone you love who's taking antidepressants, statins, or even birth control. Nutrient deficiencies can cause a huge range of symptoms, from fatigue and brain fog to skin problems and pain and so much more. So this is an issue that anyone taking medications should absolutely be thinking about. Right now, Even is offering my community free consultations and 20% off your first order. Just go to feeleven.com/Drew and use the code Drew20. That's feel, F-E-E-L, even, EVEN.com/DHRU to check out Even's full line of supplements that specifically address medication-induced nutrient deficiencies. Hi, everyone. Drew Perowit here. Obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, Polycystic ovarian syndrome and Alzheimer's disease all have one big thing in common. They all involve a component of blood sugar dysregulation. Considering the rampant use of sugar and flour in our food supply, managing blood sugar is something we should all be thinking about if we want to protect or improve our health. In today's mini episode, I speak with two folks that I super look up to in this category, Dr. Casey Means and Dr. Ben Bickman. And I talk to them about how our diet and lifestyle have fundamentally changed the way that our blood sugar is regulated and how dysregulated blood sugar is wreaking havoc on our overall metabolic health. And we all know how important that is. We also talk about optimal glucose ranges and how everyone can use a continuous glucose monitor to dramatically improve their health. Let's listen in, starting with Dr. Casey Means, a Stanford-trained physician, chief medical officer, and co-founder of metabolic health company Levels, and an associate editor of the International Journal of Disease Reversal and Prevention. She additionally is a lecturer at Stanford University. Her mission is to maximize human potential and reverse the epidemic of preventable chronic diseases by empowering individuals with tools that can facilitate a deep understanding of our bodies and inform personalized and sustainable dietary and lifestyle choices. For context, give us a little bit of the ranges, because people know about getting their fasting glucose test from the doctors. Walk us through that, and let's talk about what Levels looks at as the optimal ranges. Like, where do we want our blood sugar to be when it comes to the optimal range when we're wearing like a continuous glucose monitor?
Yeah, so talking sort of first about what the standard ranges are. So these are what the governing bodies are telling us are normal. And so when you look at fasting glucose below 100, so 100 or below of a fasting glucose, meaning your glucose when you wake up and you have not had any calories for 8 hours, if that's under 100, you're considered normal, non-diabetic, not pre-diabetic. Between 100 and 125, it's pre-diabetic fasting glucose range. And if you are 126 or above, you're considered to have type 2 diabetes. So what that means is that if you have a fasting glucose of 99 when you walk into the doctor's office, it's very likely that the doctor's going to say, you know, you're normal. You have a normal fasting glucose. I think a lot of people are realizing that that might not be the way we should be looking at this, because is 99 really optimal if you're 1 point away from being pre-diabetic? Does that mean that you're totally in the clear? The answer is no. And the research suggests that as you move higher in the normal range towards a pre-diabetic fasting glucose level, your risk for a whole host of diseases, from stroke to heart disease to, of course, developing type 2 diabetes or obesity, all go up very significantly. So if we really dig into the research, it's probably more likely that having a fasting glucose between about 70 and 85 is going to lead to much better health outcomes than if your glucose is fasting glucose is 99, even though both are within this bucket category of normal. And so I think there's a real opportunity in the research community to start setting some guidelines around what are optimal ranges as opposed to just normal ranges. Because these ranges that were created, you know, normal, pre-diabetic, diabetic, this is for risk stratification. This is for helping doctors understand, you know, when to prescribe medications, resource allocation, but it's not actually telling us what we should be shooting for optimal health. The same is true for post-meal glucose values. So we think about fasting glucose, which is when you haven't eaten anything for 8 hours, but then we also think about what are the ranges for after you eat something, where do you want to be? So right now, if you look at the International Diabetes Federation, they would say that you want to stay generally under 140 milligrams per deciliter after a meal. So let's say your glucose is 80 before lunch and then goes up and stays under 140 and then comes back down, that's considered to be fine. Again, I would argue that that's probably higher than we want to go after every meal. If you know, you look at actually the literature, they've done quite a few studies where they've put continuous glucose monitors on healthy non-diabetic populations. And the vast majority of time, like well over 90% of the day, people are actually spending their time between a range of 70 and 120. So that's probably closer to where we want to be even after meals, is like under 120. I tend to shoot for like under 110 or 100 or so after meals. So really only getting up at most like 30 points elevated after eating something. So let's say I start at 80, I don't really want to go above 110. If I start at 90, I don't really want to go above 120. So shooting for these narrower ranges, I think, is going to, you know, ultimately lead us to feel better during the day. If I go from 80 to 140 and back down, that's to me going to feel like a pretty big crash.
One day, a little bit here and there, things get off and then you can reset. It's not a big deal. But if this is what your day looks like day in and day out, that's when we really start to have, you know, problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you also bring up a really great point, which is that like you woke up yesterday morning, you had a late meal the night before, you woke up early, like, and your glucose was maybe a little bit higher than normal. These fasting glucose levels bounce around a huge amount day to day. And based on the current way we track these things, which is you go to the doctor one time per year and you get a fasting glucose check, you'd think that like, oh, well, that probably means that these things are very static, like that I'm 85 in that 8 mg/dL. That's my fasting glucose. That's who I am, you know, but that's not the way it is at all. It bounces around all the time. I could have, you know, the perfect wellness day, like I'm eating, cooking all my food at home, really low glycemic, you know, 10 zone scores for all my meals. I do a high intensity interval training workout. I get 8.5 hours of sleep. I meditated. I took magnesium, da 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 da. And the next day, my fasting glucose is like 72. Then the next day, I could get 4 hours of sleep, have a very high carb late meal, not work out and be stressed, and my fasting glucose could be 95. Like, it could be that big of a difference. And to me, that is really empowering, because it's like, okay, if I dial in just like a few of these things and make sure I'm kind of like checking off the boxes of my different wellness practices that I know impact my metabolism, I can really move the needle here. It's also when I see that higher number, I'm like, it's okay. This is just a reminder to me that like things are kind of off course. Like I'm not in my homeostasis right now. If I let that happen for weeks and months and years where I'm doing all those behaviors that lead me to have that higher fasting glucose number, no question, that's going to continue going up. And that's going to be more of a longer term problem. But
it reminds me of, if I could just add,
yeah,
it kind of reminds me, like sometimes I'll have this conversation. It's like people are like, I don't want to know all the different numbers. I'm like, okay, how about we try this? When it comes to your bank account, how about I tell you once a year how much money is in your bank account and then try to make financial decisions based on that, right?
Yeah.
You would not know if you were hitting your budget. You wouldn't know if you're overspending, if you're underspending. But at the same time too, if you splurge a little bit one week or you have a fancy meal with your partner a night out and you spend a little bit more money than you wanted to spend, hopefully, knock on wood, if you're in a decent position, it's just one night that you spend a little bit more.
Yeah.
And then you can adjust appropriately, you adjust the budget. And that's how I see this. I don't want to wait once a year to know how much money I have in my bank account and to see how well I'm doing financially to make sure that I'm saving for retirement and all the other goals that are there. And I also don't want to obsess on a daily basis of, oh my gosh, I spent so much money today, I'm just going to abandon the whole plan and just fuck it,
yeah,
right? You want to pay attention through the process and see the trends and the averages and see, are you headed in the right direction? Do you have enough money saved for retirement? Can you buy this house that you want to buy? Can you help your parents pay off their mortgage? Can you give X amount to charity that you need to give? And the same thing happens when it comes to, you know, our glucose meters that we have, is we're just looking at these average ones to know. And if we are completely off course with certain things like our breakfast and other stuff, we can start making changes that are there. My next guest, Dr. Ben Bickman, is a world-renowned metabolic research scientist and a popular speaker on human metabolism and nutrition. Backed by years of research, Dr. Bickman's mission is to help the world appreciate the prevalence and the relevance of insulin resistance. He's the author of Why We Get Sick, which offers a thought-provoking yet real solution to insulin resistance and how to reverse pre-diabetes, improve brain function, shed fat, and prevent diabetes. One of the tools that Dr. Ben Bickman and myself find most helpful for proactively managing our metabolic health is a continuous blood glucose monitor. Dr. Bickman and I talk about how to get personalized insights from it, what to focus on when it comes to carbohydrates and fat, and which foods to limit to improve insulin sensitivity and regain metabolic health for the whole body. Now, before we jump in, just a little clarification. I am an investor in Levels, and Dr. Bickman is an advisor to Levels. I so believe that we want to democratize medicine and make these continuous glucose monitors available to everyone, that I put my money where my mouth is and I'm investing in Levels. So one, just wanted you to know transparently, because I always disclose where I'm involved with companies. It's either marked as an ad or I'll let you know that I'm an investor. And number two, big picture, because we want these things to be accessible, we have to acknowledge that right now, some of these solutions are expensive. If you go and sign up for Levels, or you go and sign up for another app that's out there, or even if you go to your doctor and you convince them to give you a blood glucose monitor, you're probably going to be paying somewhere between $300 and $400 a month for the sensors. It's expensive, and that needs to change. We need to get insurance companies to cover the cost of this. And that's why Levels and Dr. Bickman and myself and Dr. Hyman are speaking up. And we need to continue to create innovation, because when more people have a technology, they end up bringing the cost of it down. Flat screen TVs used to cost an arm and a leg back in the day. Now they're a lot cheaper, and you can get one for a few hundred dollars on Amazon instead of a few thousand dollars. But we hope the same thing happens with glucose monitors. So just wanted to add that in before we jump into Ben Bickman's part into today's mini episode. If you are interested in Levels, you can sign up for it using the link below, which is an invitation into the app, because it's in private beta at the moment. And if it's not in the cards for you right now, don't worry, there's still tons of free things that you can do to improve your metabolic health. And Dr. Ben Bickman goes into them in this next clip. Let's listen in. And we've talked a little bit about carbohydrates, but just so that we're clear for everybody who's listening, you know, we're talking about processed and refined carbohydrates that are often in these processed foods, even health foods, right? Health foods that are out there. Not to mention that a lot of times people will add just straight up sugar, because when you remove the, when you're trying to make gluten-free products taste better, especially if they're dairy-free too, and you've removed the fat, you got to pump it with a ton of sugar just to make up for
to
that.
Make it not, you know, be a lack cardboard. Of taste.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, vegetables are carbs too, but just give them the contrast here. Why vegetables, for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. Broccoli, other vegetables that we'd be eating, we're not really talking necessarily about that. Just help people understand, just so that's super clear.
Yeah. So I want to emphasize that my view on carbohydrates is control carbohydrates, which at its simplest definition is don't get your carbs from a bag in a box with a barcode. That's the simplest way of my view of carbohydrates. I'm not saying we can't eat them, not at all. But it's typically going to be carbohydrates that are the biggest offender when it comes to trying to control glucose and insulin. So just be smart about it. And in general, at the simplest level, focus on fruits and vegetables. If a person's building their carbohydrate consumption around fruits and vegetables, we almost don't need to go any further. Eat, but I would say eat them, don't drink them. Don't juice them and make, you know, a smoothie maybe to a degree, but certainly not juice. But eat fruits and vegetables and just be much more careful with grains. That's generally the way it goes. And that alone is often going to be enough. But when someone's ready to go to the next level, or if they need to because they have a family history of type 2 diabetes or they already have type 2 diabetes, then my next level is, while you've been focusing on fruits and vegetables, now it's time to remove the biggest offenders in that category, which is going to be like, if a vegetable grows in the ground, then be careful with it. I'm not saying you can't eat it, but it's going to just naturally be much starchier. If the vegetable grows above the ground, it's generally one you can have almost as much as you want to shove in your face. It's going to have such a modest effect on glucose and insulin.
Right. The contrast between, let's say, broccoli above ground and then even something that can be healthy and in moderate form, but out of control can spike you crazy, would be like a potato or even sweet potatoes, which a lot of people eat. Sweet potatoes grows underground. It's a lot starchier. Anybody who wears a CGM or knows anything about, you know, blood sugar knows that if you eat a big bowl of sweet potatoes or have some, you know, a big bowl of sweet potato fries, that can spike you almost. It's almost the equivalent in your body as a Coca-Cola, right? Or a soft drink that's there.
Yep. So that's that next level. So in general, I don't mean at all to declare war on carbohydrates. Far, far from it. I think they can be a wonderful, healthy part of a smart diet, but we can't get them from bags and boxes with barcodes. Focus on fruits and vegetables. Eat them, don't drink them. And then if someone needs a little further push, well, then it gets to that next level of, all right, well, let's scrutinize your vegetables and, you know, some of your fruits to avoid the starchiest or the most sugary of those. But often we don't need to go that far. If a person is, but no, someone would hear us and say, oh, well, so Ben is saying at a high level, potatoes can be okay. And I am at a high level saying that, but that is not the same as eating potato chips. You know, and that's back to my point. If it comes in a bag or a box with a barcode, beware. How's that for some alliteration? How many B's can I put in a row? Beware.
So yeah. Those are some of the categories of foods on the offenders. Give us some examples. You know, we talked about the importance of fat. We talked a little bit about protein. Give us some examples of foods that not only fuel your body, but also fuel your brain. What are some of the positive things? I mean, vegetables are positive too, but yep. Typically we've had this war on fat for years. Yep. And if that's starting to change a little bit, even with big personalities like Malcolm Gladwell starting to do, you know, having done some podcast episodes, helping people understand yep. how we got it wrong when it came to fat. My business partner, Dr. Mark Hyman, writing a whole book on fat. You talk about it a bunch in your book, Why We Get Sick. So let's talk about fat as a category and some of the staple fats that we can have in our diet that are beneficial when it comes to this whole topic that we're going in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So fats, I am a big friend of fats in the diet for two main reasons. One is that they are, in fact, essential. There are fats that humans must eat to survive. So we have a genuine biological imperative to eat certain fats. And then two, of all three macronutrients, fat is quite unique because fat alone, which of course people don't eat it that way, but it's powerful in that fat does not have an effect on insulin. If someone's eating fat, again, we don't do that, and I'll get to that point in a moment, but fat isn't an insulin-spiking nutrient. So maybe to keep it at that level for a moment longer, I am a great defender of natural fats or ancestral fats or any other terms we could use there. And that is to say the fats that we as a species have been eating since time immemorial. Obviously, animal fats fit into that. This is beyond debate. It's surprising that it's ever debated. It certainly shouldn't be. We as humans are omnivores and we've been eating animals since the beginning of our species. And in fact, one of the leading theories of evolution, which is all theoretical, of course, is that we became humans because we ate animals. That's something called the expensive tissue hypothesis, and I won't get into that. But someone could look it up. But it's possible.
I want to chime in there because it is important. When you look it up, if you are excited to know that our brain wouldn't be what it is today if we didn't learn how to cook and especially concentrate calories, which came yep. in the form of animal fats.
Yep, that's exactly proteins. Right. Yep, you encompassed it perfectly. I couldn't have said it better myself. Yep, so eating animals might have made us human, but that, of course, that's all theoretical. But the animal fats I defend, we are well adapted to eating those because we've been eating them since the very beginning of time, human time. And then two, fruit fats. Fruit fats are the fats that our ancestors would have needed nothing more than to simply step on it or press it with some simple kind of lever. But essentially, this is fat that's coming from the flesh of a fruit. And the fatty fruits are coconuts, avocados, olives. I think that's it. I think those are the main ones. And there might be one or two more. But those fruit fats are, again, we're well adapted to them. They're saturated and they're predominantly saturated in monounsaturated fats. There's no problem with that. We know what to do with those. They're a healthy part of the diet. And again, I suspect part of the reason they're healthy is that we've been eating them for so long. You know, it's thousands of years that we've been just scooping out the flesh of a coconut and pressing it to get oil. We've been stamping on the olives to get oil from the olives. This is something we've been doing. Now, the offenders in the fat category, lest anyone think I'm giving fat just carte blanche, eat as much as you want, any kind, no, far from it. And that's because the most commonly consumed fat now in the U.S., and in fact, I suspect in throughout Asia, it's a different kind, but it's in that same family. But the average American gets more of his and her calories from soybean oil than any other single source of fat. So that introduces this other family of fats, which is the industrial seed oils. That's the best term. People will commonly call it vegetable oil. Like when I was living in Asia, including a talk I gave in India, you see vegetable oil bottles everywhere. It's vegetable oil. And everyone thinks It's a good thing because we've had that idea so thoroughly beat into our heads. Indeed, you and I were just saying how vegetables are wonderful and can be a wonderfully healthy part of the diet. But it's such a misnomer because these are oils that are not coming from vegetables. Vegetables don't give oils. These are oils coming from seeds like cotton seed or corn seed or from the seeds of the corn or as I said, soybean oil. These seed oils are enriched with a type of fat that our body, we're eating tens of thousands of times more now than we ever have in all of human history. And there's a compelling manuscript published by a man named Christopher Ramsden, who works at the National Institutes of Health, the NIH here in the U.S. He published a paper looking at changes in fat consumption in the U.S. for the last 100 years from 1909. And at the time, this was in the 2010s when he published this report. And it's shocking to see beef consumption, the fat that we get from beef, which is looked at as, you know, the great offender here, it's almost totally consistent. It started to go up, it went down, and it's kind of went back to where it was about 100 years ago. And then we look at soybean oil, and it went from nothing to being the number one, by a wide margin, the number one consumed fat in the American diet. And I would say at this point, it's essentially reflected in various ways as the global diet now. And then even fat number two was shortening, which I think is a mix of cottonseed oil and some other seed oils. But the two main consumed fats in the average American and maybe even global diet are from these seed oils. And that's so relevant because we've long been saying that saturated fats are the origins of heart disease. But you look at the consumption of saturated fats, like from beef and eggs, it has not moved in 100 years as a percent of our diet. And so that directly, you look at heart disease and it's spiking, well, then you'd expect saturated fat consumption to be spiking, and it's flat. The only fat consumption that follows this trend in heart disease and obesity and diabetes and dementia are the seed oils. That has gone from nothing, never having been no part of our diet as humans, to now becoming the single largest source of fats in our diet. So we need to focus on fats. Certainly, they're healthy, but they need to come from these ancestral fats like animals and fruits.
Thanks to technological advances like continuous glucose monitoring, we can now understand how we respond individually to high carbs in our diet and sugars like never before. For one person, a sweet potato might be easy to handle metabolically. And by the way, sweet potatoes are healthy. It's really when we overdo it in our diet, and that's one of the only things that we're eating, that it becomes challenging. And also, for another, it could mean a giant rise and fall of blood sugar with a corresponding insulin spike. At the end of the day, if you're eating whole foods, you're going to be okay, but it's nice to have insights in which foods continuously spike you. This is all about the long-term game. No one food or one instance of your blood sugar spiking is really the problem. And hey, sometimes it's nice to go out and enjoy something that spikes your blood sugar. Like, I went to Italy this summer and I had gelato like crazy. Great. That was a trip. That was a vacation. It's not how I'm eating every single day. When I get to see the data for my glucose monitor, it helps me make better decisions in real time when it comes to the 80% of what I do on an ongoing basis. And most importantly, it pays off because I get to see how what I eat makes me feel, as well as the long-term protection against chronic disease. Thanks for tuning into this week's mini episode of the Drew Pro Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have a friend that wants to learn more about metabolic health, send them this episode. It could end up changing their life. I'll see you next week.